I've got a confession to make. I hated history at school. It was taught by a retired vicar who managed to make it more dull and more boring than any other subject. It was dates, battles, kings and queens. Did you have it like that? It all seemed so complicated and so irrelevant. What was the point? What was the use of learning it all except to pass an exam? And my knowledge of history finished up very much like that book 1066 and all that. Have you read that, in which everything was either a good thing or a bad thing? Funny enough, the Book of Kings is very like that. The kings were either very good or very bad, you know. He was a bad king, he was a good king. Much of the Bible, of course, is history, but it's the history of just one nation. There's no history of China or India, much less America here. It's just the history of one people, because it's their history that's important to God. Other history may be interesting, but this history is absolutely vital for the whole of mankind. Now, we are into the second phase of the leadership of Israel, but I've got a little diagram here, which I just want to point to. Here's the year 2000 BC, here's the 1000 BC, and here's 500 BC. It took them 1,000 years from Abraham up to David to get everything that God wanted them to have. They had a few hiccups. For example, they were slaves in Egypt for 400 years. And then even after they got into the land, they had a lot of attacks from Midianites and other people, and there were real setbacks. But they went on, and gradually they got into the empire ruled over by King David. And the books of the Bible that cover this history are Genesis, and then four altogether, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, then Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel. But with Kings, we're on the downhill. Both books of Kings describe how they lost all that it took them 1,000 years to get, how they lost it all. And on the way down, very quickly after Solomon, there was civil war, and there's a split then between 10 tribes in the north and 2 tribes in the south, and they never got it together again. So now there wasn't one people, Israel. The 10 tribes in the north kept the title Israel because there were 10 of them. And the 2 in the south gave themselves the title of Judah because Judah was the big one and the remnant of Benjamin was so small. So you had civil war. The 10 tribes in the north just went steadily downhill all the way until finally all 10 were taken away into Assyria. In the south, however, they had some hiccups upwards, as there'd been hiccups downwards there. There were a couple particularly under a very good king, Hezekiah, and under a boy king who began to reign at the age of 8, Josiah. But that didn't stop the downward trend permanently, and finally the 2 tribes were taken away to Babylon. They finished up where they'd begun. There were slaves in Egypt here. Now they're taken away to Assyria and Babylon. It's a tragic story. One of the main purposes of reading it is that it can happen to the church as well. And does happen. You can gain it all, and you can lose it all, and you tend to lose it more quickly than you've gained it. It's very important to study why they lost it all, what made them go downhill. Just to complete this little diagram, they did come back after 70 years, but they never got their freedom again. They were then ruled by priests rather than prophets or princes. And they were occupied by the Egyptians, by the Syrians, by the Greeks. They had a terrible time under a Greek called Antiochus Epiphanes for 3.5 years. He did the most terrible things. He sacrificed pigs on the temple altar, erected a statue of Zeus in the temple, and turned the temple vestries into brothels. And he is a picture of Antichrist. He was the worst they ever had. And then finally the Romans. And then you get the son of David, Jesus, because Joseph and Mary kept their family tree. They were descended from King David. And so you've got, in a sense, the fulfillment of 1,000 years, 500 years, 1,000 years later when Jesus, son of David, comes. Well, that's just to show you where we are when we study the book of Kings. We studied Samuel, and that took us up to the peak. But now Kings covers from there right down to there. 500 years. But oh, what a sad story. Let's just pick up some of these threads again. I told you that the leadership of Israel went through different phases. There were first the patriarchs for about 500 years. Then prophets from Moses to Samuel led them. Then kings from Saul to Zedekiah. And then after they got back, priests. That should be Joshua, not Zerubbabel. It was Joshua who was the priest, right through to Annas and Caiaphas. And so we're looking at the story of the kingdom of Israel in the book of Kings, when they were led by kings. But in Hebrew, the book is called the Kingdoms of Israel, not the Kings. In English, it's the book of the Kings, but in Hebrew, the book of the Kingdoms. And that is because the word kingdom has a particular meaning in Hebrew, which it doesn't have in English. In English, a kingdom means a piece of land, a realm. And so we are part of the United Kingdom. I have news for you. It's not united and it's not a kingdom. But otherwise, that's not a bad name for it. But we tend to think of it as something on the map. For the Hebrew, a kingdom was a reign rather than a realm. It was something that was defined in terms of authority, not in terms of area. It was essentially the degree of power, not the amount of property that a king had. And when we talk about the kingdom of God, we're not talking about a place, we're talking about a power. We're talking about a reign or a rule. And of course we are complicated by the fact that we're in what's called a constitutional monarchy, where the queen reigns, but she doesn't rule. John Major rules for the time being. So we've robbed the throne of its ruling power. And therefore, the throne has very little power in our country. The big advantage of it is, however, that it keeps power out of other people's hands, so that our armed forces and our courts of law are not under the government directly, but are responsible to the Queen. And it just saves too much power getting into politicians' hands. So it's not so much valued our monarchy for the power it wields as the power it keeps from others. You follow me? But in a true kingdom, the king has absolute power. He makes the laws. There is no parliament. There are no votes. There are no opposition parties. The king rules. And he rules by decree and not by debate. He makes a law. And everybody's got to toe the line. Would you like to live in a kingdom? Would you wish that one man ruled England and made all the laws with no parliament, no elections, no votes? You're not sure. I can convince you in 2 minutes. If I could find the right king who would be absolutely just, who would lay down his life for the people, who would see that there were no poor and no sick uncared for, now would you like to be in the kingdom? You see, the kingdom depends entirely on the character of the king. If you've got a good king, the kingdom's by far the best form of government. But if you've got a bad king, it's the worst of all. And that's why we prefer democracy, because it prevents any one person getting that much power. But as Churchill said, democracy is the worst possible form of government, except all the others. And he meant it was probably the safest. Because the trouble is, as you read history, there have been 10 times more bad kings than good kings. And as Lord Acton said, power tends to corrupt, and absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely. And when you put all the power in one man's hands, you can go very far astray, because he can be corrupted by that power. We call it a dictatorship now, but that's what a kingdom was. So we need to understand the Hebrew title for these books is the Kingdoms of Israel. And a kingdom was the rule of a man. And his kingdom ceased when he ceased. And another kingdom began. So whereas we talk about the kingdom of Israel, they talked about the kingdoms, plural, of Israel, one after the other. I just mention that because if you want to understand the phrase the kingdom of God, that's the background. You won't understand it from the phrase United Kingdom. But you do need to understand it from the book of Kings. So that the king's character and his conduct decided the fate of the nation. Until Israel had a king, the history books talk about what the people did. But as soon as they had a king, the history books of the Bible only talk about what the king did. Because you could assume that what the king did, everybody else would do. They would follow him. And he would say, this is my law, you keep it, or else. And so they followed the king, and his character was the biggest factor. If a good king, they were in peace. A bad king, they found themselves at war. And so in the book of Kings, the emphasis is on the ruler, what he did, and whether he was a good king or a bad king. And that was measured very simply by one standard, David. If he was like David, he was a good one. If he was not like David, he was a bad one. David became the kind of yardstick, mainly in his earlier years before his downfall. And people looked, is he like David? Does he live like his father David did? That's how they judged. But behind that was a deeper reason. If they lived like David, they did what was good in the sight of the Lord. If they didn't, they did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And as you read Kings, it's very simple. They're either good or evil kings. I've told you how Samuel was told they wanted a king and told them kings come expensive. In fact, he tried to say, you already have a king. God is your king. Do you know, way back in the days of the judges, when Gideon defeated the Midianites, they came to Gideon and said, we want you to be our king and to start a dynasty. We want your son to inherit the throne after you and then your grandson. We want a king. And Gideon was very wise. Gideon said, I will not be your king. You already have one. God is your king. But I'm afraid they later changed their minds and they got their kings. Now, it's very interesting. This is not a straight history book in the normal sense, because the proportion of pages given to each king varies so much. For example, there was a king called Omri in the north who had an outstanding reign. Politically, he was a genius. Economically, he lifted them. He did a tremendous... He was a mighty king, and yet he's dismissed in the book of Kings in 7 verses. Because however efficient he was at kinging, he did evil what was evil in the sight of the Lord. So in God's sight, whatever great achievements he had, nothing. See? That's how God judges prime ministers. They may achieve tremendous things, but God doesn't look at that. He says, how did he live? What did he believe? How did he behave? And therefore, you get another king to whom whole chapters are devoted. And this proportion tells you an awful lot about God's point of view. It is certainly based on history, but it is a selection. No history is objective. When anybody sits down to write history, they do 3 things. Number one, they select. Selection is the first thing they have to do, which means out of everything that's happened, you select what you think is important. The next step of a historian is connection. He then has to show how the things he has selected connect with one another, how this led to that. And the third step is explanation as to why this led to that. So every historian goes through these 3 steps of selection, connection, and explanation. And therefore he is entirely governed by what he thinks is important and how he thinks these events connect up and why he thinks A leads to B leads to C. And here we have not objective history, there's no such thing. We have subjective history, but it's God writing. That is why, as I've told you, in the Old Testament, the books of Samuel and Kings are called the former prophets, along with Joshua and Judges. Because this is history written by prophets, written from a prophetic point of view, from God's angle. And it's God who's selecting what is important. It's God who's connecting things up. It's God who's explaining why things have happened and turned out as they have. So we're not reading history. We're actually reading prophecy. And it comes in the second part of the Jewish Old Testament. They have the law, which is the first 5 books, the law of Moses. The prophets, both the former and the latter prophets. And the writings, which is a kind of miscellaneous collection of everything else, like Psalms and Proverbs. They have the latter prophets, and they're Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the 12 minor prophets. Now, we tend to call these books history and those books prophecy, but they were wiser. The Jews say, no, it's former prophets and later prophets or latter prophets. Got it? Well, now, let's move on. And we're studying the history of the kingdom of Israel. This is holy history. It's history with a moral, a record with a message. It's not just a lesson about history, but it's a lesson from history. There's a big difference. Somebody says history repeats itself. It has to, because nobody listens. And others have said that if you forget the past, you are condemned to relive it. And that's why history is important, because otherwise we're going to make the same mistakes and we're not going to learn. And that's why we read this history. It's about history and a lesson from history. And there's such a clear pattern. If you add up the reigns, or as the Jews would say, the kingdoms of each king, you will find an astonishing fact. Add the number of years together and divide by the number of kings, and you will find this, that every good king reigned on average 33 years. Isn't that interesting? But every bad king reigned on average 11 years. That's how history works out. On the whole, you will find through history that good governments last longer than bad ones. And good rulers last longer than bad ones. If you average it out, that is what demonstrates God's control of history. We do live in a moral universe. And bad rulers tend to be shorter. In this case, one third shorter. If the good kings reign on average 33, and the bad kings on average 11, then it's saying quite simply, God will keep good kings on the throne three times as long as bad ones. Right? And that's why we're told so carefully how long each king reigned, so that you can work all this out. It means that when you read the book of Kings, you do need to do your sums and to do a bit of thinking about what you're reading. Otherwise it just says, oh, and he reigned for 30 years and he reigned for 15 years. You say, how boring. No, it isn't. It's fascinating. See, when you work it out mathematically, you find that God is in charge of history. And that still applies right through history. Good civilizations have lasted longer than bad ones, because God is on the throne. Well now, the kingdom, as we call it, of Israel, went through three stages. The first was the United Kingdom. And there were three kings that reigned over the whole of Israel, all 12 tribes, but only three. The first was Saul, and he was a baddie. Second was David, he was a goodie. And the third was Solomon, he was a mixture. But in fact, God gave united Israel three reigns of exactly 40 years each. Now that is significant, because 40 is always the number of God testing people. 40 days in the wilderness, 40 years in the wilderness. 40 is God's number of, what's the word I'm wanting? Before he approves or disapproves. It's the trial period. 40 years is a trial period in God's sight. And so when all the tribes were together, God gave these three kings a full trial period. This was a test of kingship. But I'm afraid they failed the test. All of them started well. All of them finished badly. And yet one of them was still a man after God's own heart. But none of them was good right through the 40 years. So the United Kingdom failed. 1 Samuel covers Saul's 40 years, 2 Samuel covers David's 40 years, and 1 Kings 1 to 10 covers Solomon's 40 years. As soon as Solomon died, the north and the south split and had civil war. There had been a growing tension, I've told you already, because all the prosperity seemed in the south, around the capital, and all the poverty seemed to hit the north. And there was a lot of grumbling going on in the north that the government in Jerusalem was only interested in the southeast. Sorry. You know what I mean? Yeah. We know this only too well. And it happens that where the king and the government is, there's more prosperity and more interest in things happening. And so as soon as Solomon died, no one could hold the 12 tribes together. 2 tribes stayed in the south, and they kept the capital and the royal line. The 10 tribes in the north lost both. And so they didn't have a place of worship, and they didn't have the royal line of David. So what did they do? They set up their own centers of worship, 2 of them, Bethel and Dan. And to give some object for people to attract attention of the people, they set up two huge golden calves in Bethel and Dan. And they elected their own king, a man called Jeroboam. Interestingly enough, I've got the seal of Jeroboam there. It's got the lion on it. That's always been the symbol of Israel. And there's Jeroboam's name. And that seal is a copy, yes, I know. But it was dug up at Megiddo. And that's the very seal of the man they elected, Jeroboam. And he was not of the royal line of David. And from then on, in the north, they had one dynasty after another. They had assassination, they had coup d'etat, they had takeovers. And it's a very sad tale. So they had centers of worship with golden calves. And they had kings, usually self-elected, who just killed the previous king. And the story in the north is really quite sad. Furthermore, for 80 years after the split, there was war between the north and the south. In fact, the tribes in the north, on one occasion, actually made a treaty with Syria and Damascus to wipe out the two little tribes in the south. That was during the days of Isaiah, and you can read all about it in Isaiah. They had 80 years war, then they had a bit of peace, 80 years of peace. Notice that these 80s are twice 40s, but they had a time of peace between the north and the south. But it was during that time of peace that God sent them two prophets who play a huge part in the book of Kings. Elijah in 1 Kings 17 to 20, to 2 Kings chapter 2, and Elisha followed him. You can see that these two prophets were terribly, terribly important in the north during that time when the north and south weren't fighting. But I'm afraid after Elijah and Elisha, they went back to war and fought each other and played each other dirty tricks again. It wasn't long before Assyria came and took the 10 tribes called Israel off to Assyria in 721 BC. They became the 10 lost tribes. They're not totally lost because God knows where they are. They're scattered, but the book of Revelation promises that God will bring those 12 tribes back from wherever they've been. So God knows. He keeps a record. And now we're left with a single kingdom. It's a very small kingdom now. Just Judah and little Benjamin in the south. Little bit of land around Jerusalem. But they still have the capital city. They still have the royal line of David. And their kings are still descended from David. But wouldn't you have thought that when they saw 10 of their fellow tribes taken off, that they would say, hey, we must pull our socks up. Or God will send us away too. You'd have thought that, wouldn't you? If 10 members of your family were kidnapped and disappeared, and you were told by God, and you too will disappear if you don't behave yourselves, wouldn't you pull your socks up? No, no. The tragedy is that they didn't either. And God never punishes anyone without warning them first. It's a lovely thing about God. He said through the prophet Amos, I'll never do a thing unless I send a prophet first to tell people what I'm going to do. That's why God sent Elijah and Elisha to the north, and why he later sent Amos and Hosea, but Hosea was the last. And after Hosea, no more. After that, God sent prophet after prophet after prophet to the two tribes that were left. He sent Isaiah, he sent Micah, he sent Nahum, he sent so many. And yet they didn't listen either. And the tragedy is that in 587 BC, notice that's about 140 years later, little Judah was taken away, this time to Babylon. And that's the end of the story of the book of Kings. I've given you a sort of oversight there. Keep it in mind that when you read the book of Kings, you're reading first of all the United Kingdom under Solomon, then you're reading the divided kingdom, and during that time it's very disturbing. You're constantly going from one side to the other. Have you noticed when you read it? The king of Judah did this, and then the king of Israel did that, and then the king of Judah. And he's trying to keep up with them both. It's really quite confusing. We'd much rather he told us the whole story of the north and then the whole story of the south. But he does it because they were interacting either in war or peace with each other. So he's got to keep up the two stories simultaneously. Then it simplifies when we're left with only the two tribes in the south, Judah, from which we get the word Jew. The word Jew doesn't come earlier than this. It's Hebrew before this, or Israeli, or Israelite. But now, for the first time, the word Jew comes in, a word that became very, very common in the gospel story when Jesus came. But you realize that, I'm just throwing this in, because for centuries Christians have misunderstood John's gospel, which keeps saying the Jews killed Jesus. And I'm afraid the Christian church has included all Jews in this and really done terrible things to the Jewish people for 20 centuries. You Jews killed Jesus. But when John, writing his gospel, says the Jews killed Jesus, he doesn't mean all the Israelis. He means the people of Judah. In other words, the people of Jerusalem in the south. He is not including the Galileans. The Galileans flocked to Jesus. They loved him. It was only when he went south to Judah and Jerusalem that the Jews hated him. Do you follow me? So when you read the Jews in the Gospel of John, don't think that's all the Israelis. It's the southerners, not the northerners. I just throw that in because we could have avoided centuries of misunderstanding had we realized that. Jew means someone from Judah. And of course, since these two tribes came back afterwards from the exile, it was just Jews who came back, and that's why the name has stuck ever since. Hope that's explained a little something to you. Well, now let's ask a few basic questions. Who wrote this book or these books? How did he write it? When did he write it? And why did he write it? Who? We don't know. Most Jews think it was Jeremiah. It's like him. There are parts of the book of Kings that are identical in wording with parts of the book of Jeremiah. And we know that the prophets wrote history because they saw it God's way. So it could be Jeremiah. Others think it's Ezekiel. I think it was Jeremiah for one reason. He's not mentioned. But he was right in the middle of this. And there's not a word about him. And I cannot think that anybody else would write about this period of history and never mention Jeremiah. But if he was writing it himself, he wouldn't. He'd written his prophecies down separately. And there are one or two other pointers. So for my money, it was Jeremiah. But we don't know. We have to leave that question. So how was it written? Well, time and again in the book of Kings, it says, as it is written in the Acts of Solomon, as it is written in the books of the Chronicles of the King of Israel, as it is written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah. He is clearly using national records. He's using other people's records and weaving them together to communicate a lesson about history. There are even parts of Isaiah which are word for word the same as Kings. So whether Isaiah was writing those bits or Jeremiah got them from Isaiah, I don't know. But he was using the normal historical method. He was using his sources, gathering material from libraries, but then he was putting it together in such a way that we'd get a profound lesson from looking at what happened. When was it written? Well, a lot of it was written before they were taken away to Babylon, because he mentions that the temple is still standing, and he frequently uses this phrase, as it is to this day. As you go through the book of Kings, you'll constantly find things, as it is to this day. So clearly he was writing before the whole thing collapsed. And yet, the last little bit of Kings finishes halfway through the exile in Babylon with the most extraordinary little piece of news. The Babylonians had killed the last king of Judah, a man called Zedekiah. They'd been very horrible to him. They'd tied him up in chains, and then they'd lined up his sons in front of him, and they'd killed every son of Zedekiah. And then when he'd seen all his sons die, they took his eyes out and blinded him and took him away in chains. That was Zedekiah. The previous king, however, Jehoiakim, was a weak king, and he hadn't tried to oppose the Babylonians. So, in fact, they had taken him as prisoner. And the last thing in the book of Kings is that Nebuchadnezzar, that's the king of Babylon, released their second last king from prison and invited him to dine at the king's table from then on. Now that's very, very interesting. It's the last bit of news in the Book of Kings. It means that it was completed halfway through the exile. That's very significant, as you'll see in a minute. And it means that this royal line of David actually began to have his meals at the king's table in Babylon. And you'll find that man's name in the genealogy of Jesus. Because the royal line of David was thus preserved by Nebuchadnezzar. And came back. And the royal line came back in the person of a man called Zerubbabel. But we'll know more about him when we study another book. So all through this, disaster after disaster, horror after horror, the royal line was kept. But they lost even Jerusalem, the city of God's name. Well, now, that brings us to the most important question. Why was it written? We can now see a clear reason. Here is an entire nation that has lost its land, lost its capital, been taken away forcibly, and that generation will never see home again. And they must have talked like this. God's deserted us. God doesn't love us anymore. Why has God let this happen to us? It's the sort of thing you would ask if this happened to you and your children and you'd been forcibly removed from your land and knew you'd never see home again. You'd be full of questions. Where's God? Our God has let this happen to us. The whole of the Book of Kings is an answer to why has God let this happen. The writer is saying it's your own fault. God hasn't broken his promises to you. He's kept them. He promised to do this to you if you misbehaved. So don't you blame God. God has kept his promise. And he's using all these records of the kingdoms of the slide down to show them that one thing is certain. God is faithful to his word. This is not an accident. You caused it to happen because you knew what God had said he would do. And yet you ignored him. But then that's human nature. We know deep down that God will judge us one day for how we live. What do we do about it? See, human nature is so perverse, so stiff-necked, to use God's adjective, that we go on living in a way that we know makes God angry. And we trade on his patience. Like the German poet Heine, who was an atheist Jew, who finished up in Paris and died young after a lifetime of sin. They called a priest to hear his confession, and he refused to make a confession. He just said as he lay dying, Dieu me pardonnera, c'est son métier. God will forgive me, that's his trade. And Heine's dying words go down as someone who took advantage of God's patience and didn't realize that God's patience can run out. It took hundreds of years, but in the long term, the mills of God grind slowly, but they grind exceeding small. We need to remember that judgment does come. Sooner or later, we pay. Well, that's why the book is written. And it just uses history as a profound lesson to these people. And yet there is hope. Even in this dark book, there's hope because God has promised never to break his part of the covenant. Again and again, I've underlined it every time it comes in the Old Testament. God says, you may break the covenant, I never will. Therefore, when you are taken away to another land, I will bring your children back. God keeps his promise. He never breaks a word. He promised he'd take them out of the land. But he promised to bring their children back. And he did. They were 70 years in Babylon. Do you know why? Probably told you before. Because God had made a law that they must let the soil rest every seventh year. Let it have a holiday so that it could be rejuvenated. And they had ignored it for all those 500 years from Solomon onwards. Now, if you work that out, how many years holiday had the land missed? 70. And God said, if you won't give the land a rest, I will. And you stay out of the land until it's caught up with its holidays. It's all there. It all fits together. And so that's why it's written. If it was Jeremiah, he said, I'm going to write the history of the last 500 years so that the people will get the message. This disaster has come on the whole 12 tribes because they didn't keep the covenant. But it's not hopeless. God has promised to keep the royal line of David going. He's promised to bring the children back. And he will do that too. Well, now, in the last talk, I gave a kind of overview of the both books of Kings, which in the Hebrew Old Testament are one book, just the kingdoms of Israel. And I want now to go over the story again, but looking in greater detail at some of the kings and some of the crises that are covered. And the first king I'd like to say a bit more about is King Solomon. He begins the book of Kings, and it's his reign that seems on the one hand so good and on the other hand so bad. Solomon was a good man. He began well. In fact, at the beginning of his reign, God appeared to him in a dream and said, I'll give you anything you ask me. Now that's a real test of a man's character. If God said to you, I'll give you anything you ask me, wealth, fame, power, whatever you ask me, I'll give you. And Solomon said, wisdom, please. He said, because I'm inexperienced as a king. And if I'm going to be a good king, I need to be a wise king. And I need wisdom that I don't have. And God said, because you asked for wisdom, I'll give you everything you didn't ask for as well. I'll give you wealth and fame and power. But above all, I'll give you wisdom. When he woke up, he was faced with a situation that really needed wisdom. Here were two prostitutes arguing about one baby. They both had babies, but during the night, one had been smothered or had a cot death and was gone. And now each of them was saying, it was the other one's baby that died and that's mine. Now can you imagine a more difficult situation for a judge to sort out than two women each swearing the baby was theirs? But Solomon had asked for wisdom, and he got it. And the Lord said, just tell them to cut the baby in half. Give half to each. And as soon as Solomon said that, the real mother said, let her have it. The one who wasn't the mother said, yes, cut it in half. Because that would kill the other one's baby. And it was solved. So simple. If I can give you a modern illustration, because a word of wisdom is available to all who've been baptized in the Spirit. A young couple came up to me in a meeting in Islington in London, and they said, Mr. Pawson, if you can't help us, we're going to get divorced. I said, well, I've only got 5 minutes before I have to leave. And I said, how long have you been married? 3 months. And I said, you're going to get divorced after 3 months. I said, how did you meet? And then it came out. She offered to be a prison visitor, and they sent her to a men's prison to visit men. Now that's asking for trouble anyway. Anyway, she met this very rough lad and led him to the Lord. He was soundly converted. She taught him the Bible. She discipled him. And after some years, he came out. And he said, I have no family, no home, nowhere to go. And she was getting on for 30, single girl living on her own in a flat. She had no family either. He said, you know, I'm very fond of you. In fact, he said, I've fallen in love with you. She said, well, I like you. And they went straight away from the prison gates and got married. Moved into the apartment, and then they found out they were totally incompatible. Because it's not enough just to be two Christians, you know. And he never used a knife and fork, ate with his fingers. When he undressed at night, he just dropped his clothes where he stood, and in the morning jumped into them and pulled them up. And she'd been brought up with flowers and lace curtains and everything in the drawer, you know. And in every way, they were totally incompatible. And after 3 months, they said, we've made the biggest mistake in our lives. Can you help us? 5 minutes. I said, Lord, a word of wisdom. And he gave me one. And I said, listen carefully. This is what you're to do. You're to do week on, week off. The first week, you both do things his way. And you, pointing to the girl, you've got to throw your clothes on the floor and learn to eat with your fingers. But the next week, you're both doing things her way. And you've got to learn to put your clothes in the drawer and to eat with a knife and fork. And I said, you're to do that week on, week off. And the girl said, that's so weird, it's got to be of the Lord. And they said, what else? I said, I've nothing else. And off they went, and I've never seen them since. But I had a lovely letter 6 months later. Dear David, we never knew married life could be so wonderful. We are blissfully happy. Trouble is, they never told me if they were still doing it. But you see, now I've got the answer. I can write a book called Week On, Week Off. But I'll tell you something. I've never passed that word on to anybody else, because God gave the word of wisdom for them. James says, do you lack wisdom? Then ask for it. And don't doubt that you'll get it. Well, Solomon asked for it. And he got it. And he sorted it out. Wise men. He also wanted to share his wisdom with others, so he collected 3,000 proverbs. And he wrote 1,005 songs, according to the Book of Kings. But God only published about 6 of them. Now, I have a theory about this. Because he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. And God refused to publish 999 of his songs. I reckon he wrote one for each of them. And the only one you've got is about the girl of the Song of Solomon. Right? So, poor old Solomon. Would you call him wise if he had 700 mothers-in-law? Yeah. You know, actually, Solomon was like a lot of us. He had a lot of wisdom for everybody else, but none for himself. That was the tragedy. He wrote 3 books, Proverbs, or Song of Songs first, when he was a young man, so much in love that he forgot about God altogether, and God has no mention in the Song of Solomon. That's when he had already 60 wives, so he was well on in his career, but he met the right one. And then he wrote Proverbs, and he wrote that when he was middle-aged. Now, son, watch the women. You've got to be middle-aged to talk like that, haven't you? You know, I heard a teenage girl say to her mother, what did you do at my age that makes you so worried about me? And then he wrote Ecclesiastes, remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the legs tremble and the teeth are few and the eyes are dim. You can see Solomon's whole life, but you see, because it was a time of peace and prosperity, then philosophy came in. And he had time to develop his interests in music and agriculture and architecture. He developed many interests, but none of them satisfied him. And the book of Ecclesiastes is one of the saddest books in the Bible. When he reached old age and felt it was all vanity, all pointless, that he was getting off just where he got on. That's Solomon. He did so many good things. And he built the temple for the Lord. With the materials and the plans from his father David, he got the temple built. It was a magnificent temple. That gives you just a rough idea of it. There's Solomon's palace, and here's the temple. It took 7 years to build the temple and 12 to build his own palace. Interesting. But one of the most fascinating things it says in the book of Kings about the temple being built was that though it was built of cut stone, the sound of hammer and chisel was never heard. For many, many years, people couldn't understand that. How could you carve all those stones and never the sound of a hammer or a chisel be heard? Until somebody found a hole in the mountain, Mount Moriah it is, at the top end near Calvary. There's a hole in the cliff. And they went in and they found a gigantic cave. You can go into it if ever you go. Go around the, past the Damascus Gate and look for a little door in the cliff wall. And when you get in, it is vast. It's the size of the Albert Hall. It's enormous. And the floor is covered with millions of little chips. And the rock has been cut. And it goes for yards and yards down under the temple. And the rock here is so soft you can cut it with a penknife or with your fingernail. But when you bring a piece out into the atmosphere, it oxidizes and goes quite hard. There's a bit. That's absolutely hard rock. But it's been cut with a penknife. It's so soft you can just cut it like that. And then it oxidizes and goes hard and white. Beautiful, pure white stone. In other words, all the stone came from underneath. In this huge cave, they were cutting these blocks to fit and then sending them up. If you go to the Wailing Wall, as it used to be, they don't call it that now, they call it the Western Wall. If you ask for the Wailing Wall now, they send you to the income tax office. But the Western Wall, when you look at it, there are blocks of stone 40 feet long by 3 feet by 3 feet, which weigh 100 tons. It was cut out of this soft stuff and then brought out on rollers and put in place. And that's how Solomon built the temple. Well, it's a fascinating tale. But the sad thing is that Solomon had a weakness. We know what it was. He had too many wives. He married the daughter of Pharaoh. Because she was an Egyptian, of course, she couldn't live in the holy city. So he actually built her a palace just north of the temple, outside the city wall. And that was discovered last year. If you saw the recent television program, they found a palace with Egyptian architecture, with the lotus leaves around the pillars. The only Egyptian artifacts in the whole of Israel that have been discovered. And it's just north of the Damascus Gate. It's underneath the monastery. And they've discovered the palace that Solomon built for Pharaoh's daughters. Interesting how many things are confirming the Bible as people dig around in the dust and rubble of the Middle East. So Solomon gave them that magnificent temple. It says it was 480 years after the Exodus when he opened the temple. And if you want to read a most inspiring prayer, it's the prayer that Solomon prayed at the dedication of the temple. It was opened during the seventh month, the Feast of Tabernacles, and the glory of the Lord came down, as it had come down on the tabernacle, the tent, earlier. It's a lovely story, and yet there he was. His many wives were bringing pagan gods into the very palace, in the city where God had put his name. And the whole thing was having this profound effect on all the people. Furthermore, to get this built, he was virtually using forced labor and heavy taxation. And of course, this made the north even more resentful when they had to pay taxes to build something in the south. And you can see as you read the story that Solomon was actually laying the ground for catastrophe. But God said to him, because you built this temple for me, it will be in your son's reign that he will lose the kingdom. Interesting. But that is in fact exactly what happened. And this unrest in his son's reign, of course, led to this divided kingdom. Now, I want to single out one or two things in the rest of Kings in detail, just out of interest, because he was using different chronicles or records, one from the north and one from the south, the account of each king is a little different. When he is writing about the kings of Israel, he begins with the date when they began to reign, the name of the capital city where they reigned, the length of the reign. Then came the judgment. He did evil in the sight of the Lord. Then we get the name of his father. Then he names the source of reference for his facts, where he got the facts from, which record. He then finishes with the death and mentions the son who took over unless somebody else took the throne. And in every case, the kings of the north are described that way. And compared to the first king of the north, Jeroboam. And Jeroboam was this man and not a very good king. And so it usually says, and he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, just like Jeroboam. But in the south, using different records, there's a slight variation. The date when they began to reign, but then the age at which they began to reign, and some of them were boy kings. The length of the reign is the same. Then he gave the name of the mother, not the name of the father. I don't know why, don't ask me. But there's been an interesting change. Today you're a Jew if your mother was a Jew. Whereas in Bible days you're a Jew if your father was. There's something going on here. Then there is a judgment as to whether they were good or evil. In the north, every king was evil. In the south, some were good and some were evil. Then he says his source reference, the death, and he always mentions the burial of the southern kings, unlike the north. Mentions their grave, and then the son or successor. But these kings are evil compared to David. These kings are evil compared with Jeroboam. And the good ones here are good because they are different. That's just to help you to understand. Now let's look at the number of good kings and bad kings. It wasn't quite as simple as good. There were some who were very good. And when they were good, they were very good. And there were some who were good, some who were bad, and some who were very bad. When they were bad, they were very bad. And there was one queen. Now God had made a covenant with David that as long as his statutes were kept, there would always be a son on his throne, not a daughter. And Israel was never intended to have queens. But we'll see there was one. Now I've done the colors so that you can see very quickly what was happening. Let's look at the north. And you see straight away that most of them were very bad and a few were just bad. But none were good and certainly none were very good. And the intriguing thing is that though the north had 20 kings and the south had 20 kings, the south survived another 140 years. Because good kings reign longer. Do you see? Same number of kings, roughly, but all bad kings. So look how quickly they were replaced. Some of them only survived a couple of months and then were killed. It is a really sad story. One of the worst, of course, was a man called Jehu, but quite a bad one was Ahab. And he went and married a foreign princess, a Phoenician from Tyre. And her Phoenician name was Primrose. It was rather unfortunate that in Hebrew it meant garbage. The name was Jezebel. And so he married Princess Primrose, who in Hebrew was known as Princess Garbage. But that's Jezebel, and she was a horror. And you need to know about her because even in one of the seven letters to the seven churches of Asia in the book of Revelation, there was a Jezebel wrecking a church. And the spirit of Jezebel has survived. Jezebel had Ahab round her little finger. And Ahab saw a vineyard, and he had a lovely big estate, but he saw this nice little vineyard. And it was owned by a man called Naboth. And Ahab said to his wife one day, "You know, that's a nice little vineyard. I wouldn't mind having that in our estate." And she said, "Why don't you?" "Oh," but he said, "it belongs to Naboth." She said, "We can soon deal with that." She had the man killed. Ahab got his little back garden. That's Jezebel. And it was in that day that the first great prophet, Elijah, was sent to deal with the situation. If ever you get the chance, you must climb Mount Carmel. It's 12 miles long. It juts out to the sea. But at the eastern end of it, the inland end, there is a gigantic depression on the top of the mountain or just below the summit, which is a natural arena where 30,000 people could gather to watch something happening. And we know it must be the place where Elijah challenged the prophets of Baal, whom Jezebel had introduced to the palace, because there's a spring there which never runs dry, even in drought. Though there'd be no rain for 3.5 years, that spring was still going. A friend of mine, Leonard, who died on Christmas Day a few years ago at the age of 90, or 99 was it? But anyway, he was out there for many years as a policeman during the British Mandate, and he had an amateur hobby of archaeology. And he went up to this arena and he spent 3 days on his hands and knees going backwards and forwards to see if there was any remains of Elijah's altar. Do you remember the story? When Elijah built an altar and challenged the prophets of Baal to build their altar alongside. And he said, "Now you call for fire." It was a very clever challenge because we now know that the altars of Baal had a tunnel underneath. And a priest would climb along with a box of matches. And when the people cried out for Baal, and the fire came. And so Elijah said, "Now build one out here in the open." You see? I mean, it's brilliant. He said, "Well, watch you build it, and then you produce the fire like you usually do." And Elijah was a very bold man. And he said, now I'll build an altar for the Lord. And he said, not only that, but when I've got the wood and the sacrifice, I insist you go and fill buckets of that spring and pour water on the top. And then let's see who's God. And his boldness led him to mock the priests in such a way that if his experiment failed, he'd have been a goner. They shouted, God, Baal, Baal. He said, shout a bit louder. Maybe he's on holiday. Maybe he's on the toilet. Shout a bit louder. He actually said that. Of course, in your polite English Bibles, it says, maybe he has turned aside. But in fact, that's a euphemism for gone into the bushes to relieve himself. He's making fun of Baal. Can you imagine their anger if his didn't work? And then at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the time of the evening sacrifice, and now God, you show them. Now, my friend Leonard crawled around looking for anything, and he found a little stone the size of a goose egg. And on one side was a sheet of green glass fused to the stone. Some of you have seen it, have you? Yes. And he didn't know what it was. And he took it to the professor of geology in the Hadassah University in Jerusalem and said, can you tell me what that is? And the professor said, well, I can tell you this. You didn't find that in Israel. And he said, yes, I did, but I'm not going to tell you where till you tell me what it is. And the professor said, leave it with me for 3 days, but do you mind if we take a thin slice off it to look at it microscopically? And then he said, fine. He went back after 3 days, and the professor said, you're going to be terribly disappointed. Why? Well, it's just a lump of ordinary limestone. And Leonard said, but what's this sheet of green glass on the side? He said, I couldn't scratch that with my wife's diamond ring. And the professor said, well, he said, that's limestone too, but it's been subject to the most indescribable heat. He said, it's the kind of thing you find after an atomic bomb's exploded. And Leonard knew he'd got a piece of Elijah's altar. And he carried that in his pocket for the rest of his life. The fire of God had been on that, melted it and crystallized it out. When I took a group up there, I got them all on their hands and knees looking for me. And they'd been looking for about 10 minutes, and then suddenly they stood up and walked towards me, and I said, have you found something? They said, no, we're not going to go on looking either. I said, why? You've gone on strike? They said, we're not having our pastor worshipping relics. So I never got one. But that was the challenge. And then Jezebel heard about it, and she threatened him, and Elijah ran for his life. Amazing that one woman could frighten the prophet of the Lord. And he fled, went down to the Negev, and was so exhausted, having run all the way, that he went to sleep. And that's when an angel came and cooked a meal for him. I think that's lovely, one of the lovely. Did you know angels could cook? But how lovely of God. Instead of hammering him into the ground for running away, he said, you know, you haven't eaten for such a long time. I've sent an angel to cook a meal for you now. Get that inside you, and then we're going to talk. Beautiful. Elisha followed him, of course. One little word about Elisha. He was plowing when Elijah called him. And Elisha said, I want a double portion of your spirit. Now, that does not mean I want to be twice the prophet you've been. It means very simply that if a man had 4 sons... his estate was divided into 5 when he died, and the double portion went to the eldest son, who therefore became the heir of the family business and got the extra money to help with the responsibility. Do you follow? So in asking for a double portion of Elijah's spirit, he was asking to be his heir, to take over the business. And Elijah said, if you see me go, you can be my heir. And Elijah was one of the few people who never died, like Enoch. But Enoch walked into heaven, Elijah rode, and Elisha saw him go up in a chariot to heaven, and saw Elijah's robe fall down, and Elisha picked up that robe, and he walked to the Jordan River, because before they'd crossed the Jordan River, Elijah had taken the robe and just swung it over the river, and the water had parted, and Elisha said, now let's see if the God of Elijah is with me, and he took the robe. And the water parted. They're so different, these two. And I want you to notice this. Elijah was the fighter, the preacher, the man who challenged the people. Elisha was quite different. Elisha raised the dead. Little village, widow's son, he raised the dead. It's called Shunem. And that's only half a mile from a little village called Nain. That strike a chord with you? And Elisha fed 4,000 people with a few barley loaves of bread. That strike a chord? See, we're going to see that John the Baptist and Jesus, who were cousins, were in fact Elijah and Elisha back again. They were prefiguring those two cousins. It's a remarkable story. You should study Elijah and Elisha. Can you see that God was sending prophet after prophet after prophet to warn these people of their bad ways? From Ahijah or Ahijah, Yehu, Eliyahu, or Elijah to you, Micaiah, Elisha, Jonah. Jonah appears in the book of Kings. People think Jonah's a myth. Why is he in the book of Kings then? And Amos, and finally Hosea. Hosea, what a man. One day God said to him, I want you to go into the street and find a prostitute. What? I'm a preacher. What do you want me to do with her? Marry her. Then what, Lord? Well, then you're going to have children. But I better warn you, she will love the first child, she won't like the second, and the third will not even be yours, Mr. Preacher. Sure enough, the three children arrived. And then what, Lord? Well, then she'll go back on the street, she'll go back to her old profession. Well, what am I to do with three kids? You're to go and look for her and pay the pimp money to get her back and bring her home again and love her. And what then, Lord? Then you're to go and tell the children of Israel, that's how I feel about them. Terribly emotional book is Hosea. It was God's last appeal to a faithless wife who was running after other gods. Amazing appeal, and yet it fell on deaf ears, and they went. Looking here, you see we haven't got nearly so many bad kings. We've got one horror, the Queen Athaliah. And you know who she was? She was Jezebel's daughter. And she married the king of Judah in the south. He should have known better. And she was so jealous, she wanted to be the first queen of Israel. So what could she do? She systematically killed all the children of David's royal line, one after the other, so she could be queen. But the high priest of that day saw it coming. And he kidnapped the youngest boy, Joash, and he hid him. And when it all came out, Athaliah was dead and Joash was sitting on the throne as a boy. You can see they had two very good kings, Hezekiah and Josiah. Hezekiah was contemporary with Isaiah, and you can read part of the story in Isaiah, but there's again a mixture of good and bad. Hezekiah was a good king. He did many good things. It was he who dug the tunnel to bring the water into Jerusalem and make it safe against enemies. But he did many other good things. But then he was terribly ill. And two men came all across the Arabian desert from a little city called Babylon with a get well card from the king of Babylon. And they came and said, King Hezekiah, our king in little Babylon, has heard about your sickness. And he hopes you'll get well soon. And Hezekiah was flattered that somebody so far away knew about his illness and was concerned. Well, he said, would you like to see around my palace? And he showed him all around the palace. And he said, would you like to see around the temple, the treasures in our temple? And he showed him all the gold and silver in the temple. And then he said, go back and thank your king for sending his get well card by you. And Isaiah came into the palace and said, who were those men? Oh, they were visitors from Babylon. Brought a nice message from the king. Hope I'll be better soon. What did you show them? Oh, I showed them all my palace, and I even took them into the temple and showed them the gold and silver treasures. The Babylonians will come and take away everything you showed them. Mind you, it didn't happen for a long time, but it did happen. So Hezekiah was a mixture, both good and bad, but he did some very good things. The other king they had who did a lot of good was a king who came to the throne at only 8 years of age. And Josiah was born the same year as a man called Jeremiah. They were contemporaries, literally. And when he was eight, Jeremiah was 8. But we don't hear a word of Jeremiah in this account. Josiah was concerned that the temple was looking shabby and dusty and the paint was peeling, so he ordered a spring clean of the temple. And while they were cleaning the temple up, they came across an old cupboard covered with cobwebs, and when they opened it, inside was the scroll of Deuteronomy. Hadn't been read in years. They brought it to King Josiah, and when he read it and read the curses, he said, "Do you realize we've done everything that deserves a curse?" He said, "We must quickly put it right." And he ordered a national reformation. And they destroyed all the high places of the pagans. They destroyed all the idols. And it really seemed as if it would clean the situation up. But it didn't. Because you can't make people good by act of parliament. You can't force people to change their hearts. You can change their behavior by law, but you can't change their hearts. And Josiah made a big mistake. He decided to go to war with Egypt. And he was killed at Megiddo. And they lost this good boy king. And as soon as he died, the nation went right back because he was followed by bad kings. I've skipped over one of the worst kings. Hezekiah, the good king, was followed by Manasseh, a very bad king. Manasseh got into Satan worship. He sacrificed even his own baby sons to the devil in the valley of Hinnom, which later became Gehenna. Dreadful place. And the worst thing Hezekiah did was, he was so angry with Isaiah the prophet for his preaching that he ordered him bound and put inside a hollow tree trunk. And then he ordered two carpenters with a big saw to cut the tree in half. That's how Isaiah died, under the cruel Manasseh. Have you read Hebrews 11 where it says, "Some were sawn asunder"? That's Isaiah. That awful King Manasseh. And so the thing just fizzles out towards the end. It really is a very sad tale. Well, I've just picked up one or two outstanding things there to show you. What are we really saying? God, being God, always gave them full warning that they mustn't go on as they are. And he always does. People who think that they will be judged for ignorance are wrong. The whole principle of the Bible is God only judges us for what we know is wrong. So people who haven't heard about Jesus will not be sent to hell because they haven't heard about Jesus, but because they've done wrong in their own conscience. See, everybody knows the difference between right and wrong. They've got a conscience. And to be justified before God, all you need do is say, "God, I have always followed my conscience. I've always done what I know to be right." But who could say that? That's the problem. And so, look at the prophets they sent. I've looked at those in the south, look at those in the north. Shemaiah, Obadiah, Joel, Isaiah, Micah, Nahum, Jeremiah, Zephaniah, Habakkuk, and finally Daniel. They all had the same message. They were all warning. But people preferred false prophets. And we know what false prophets are. They say everything's going to be all right. Cheer up, it'll never happen. False prophets always have a message of peace. Peace, peace, when there is no peace. "They try to heal the wounds of my people lightly," said Jeremiah. False prophets don't hear from God. They give the people what the people want to hear. That is still the temptation every preacher faces today. Don't disturb people. Don't upset them. Comfort them. Tell them what they want to hear. And false prophets do that. True prophets tell the truth and pay the price. And through the prophets, God's words came before his deeds. The warnings came before disaster. That's the message that is written through and through the book of Kings. Let me finish. These things, says the New Testament, were written for our benefit so that we might learn what God will do to us if we go the same way. The church is not secure in itself. And there are two things that are happening in our day in the church which were condemned here. One is syncretism, and that means to unite one religion with another. When Elijah challenged the people of Israel, he said, "How long halt you with two opinions?" And I used to think the word halt there means somebody who was standing still and wondering which way to go. It doesn't mean that. The word halt means lame. Halt and lame. And it means they were walking with one foot in Yahweh, their God, and the other foot in Baal. How long are you going to walk like this, with one foot in one religion and one in another? And we now see in the church syncretism. We see festivals of faith. We see people going to Canterbury Cathedral, the Baha'is and the Hindus and the Muslims, going there to pray for the trees. This is happening in Christian churches because there is pressure on us, even from the Duke of Edinburgh. He's appealing to religions to unite to save planet Earth, the environment and the wild animals on it. We have Prince Charles, who's willing to be called defender of faith, but not defender of the faith. We are into an era when it's become fashionable to say all religions lead to God. That's syncretism. The other thing, we are into pagan festivals, of which harvest festivals and Christmas and blessing of everything from pets to plows and fishermen's nets is all the kind of practice. Halloween, why do people carve pumpkins? They're carving demons' faces. And if we're not careful, Christians get hooked on these things as well. Christmas is the most obvious example. It's a totally pagan festival. And it comes from days before Christ when they burned logs, yule logs, they sang carols, they ate and they drank overmuch. It was the midwinter festival. And when the first missionary came to England, he sent word back to Rome and saying, "I can't get them away from this pagan festival in midwinter." And Pope Gregory said, "Well, if you can't lick them, join them. Turn it into a Christian festival." That's how it's come. I believe we've got to get Christ out of Christmas. Amen. Not get him back into it. Because it is basically pagan, and it's the pagan side that takes over. Well, need I go on? We see in the Book of Kings the dangers are becoming too mixed up in other religions and other ways of life and other moralities, and it's happening. But the God who is the King of the universe is also our judge, and sooner or later we will lose what he's given to us unless we wake up. That's the lesson from the Book of Kings. It's a sharp lesson. If it happened to them, it can happen to us too. So God, give us wisdom to understand the lessons he's trying to teach us, that we may learn the easy way by learning from others instead of learning the hard way for ourselves. You can either learn wisdom because it's been passed on to you, or you can learn it in the school of experience whose colors are black and blue. Two ways of getting wisdom. That's why Solomon wanted to pass it on to his son. "Now, son, take it from me. Don't learn the hard way yourself. Take it from me." The Bible is able to make us wise unto salvation. It doesn't make you clever, but it'll make you wise and avoid the terrible mistakes that God's people of old made.